Welcome everybody to RFRX on hopefully happy Valentine's Day, where we're here to talk about narcissists and sociopaths, as one does. Joining me here today as co-host is Sasha D'Souza. Sasha, how are you doing this evening?
I'm doing well. Thanks, Kara. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here with everyone.
Yes, I am so excited to be back on and excited to be hanging out here with you and with our fabulous guest, who is a repeat that everyone is super excited about. So I cannot wait to get started. Sasha, what's going on with you this evening? How come you're here with us?
Well, I'm doing well. So we've got one of our regular hosts, Eric, away on holiday at the moment. So it's you and I here to help liaise and help this chat keep going. And yeah, we're doing well here in Australia. It's a beautiful day today too. Absolutely gorgeous start to the day. And yeah, it's great to be here. How's things for you?
Excellent. Things are well here. I am excited to be here as well. I'm finally not teaching on a Monday evening, so I'm super pleased to be here for this excellent show. And I guess it's always tomorrow there for you guys in Australia, right? So, I mean, I don't know how the rest of my day is going to go, but maybe you can tell me if it went all right or not.
It'll be perfect. Yeah, yesterday on my yesterday, I sat there on Sydney Harbour with beautiful views over the Harbour Bridge and the Opera House and gorgeous blue skies. So that was my Valentine's Day. And so I think it's going to be good for you all as well, based upon that.
Excellent. I am glad to hear it. We are here for the predictions. You're a medium, right?
I am. I'm a prophet. Yes.
Yeah. Without further ado, let me go ahead and introduce our fantastic guest, David Teachout, who is an educator and trainer for healthcare providers and other professionals, and also a many time returning guest here at RFRX. He also has a private practice helping adults and couples with learning resiliency skills related to relationship difficulties and trauma. He hosts a podcast, Humanities Values, and a blog related to mental health topics. David has worked in mental health care for 15 years and holds a master's in both forensic and counseling psychology, and is currently working toward a doctor of psychology in clinical psychology. Woot. He's also worked in community mental health, social work, criminal justice, elder care, and child advocacy. So pretty much all the things. So David, I am so glad you are here and I am so excited for this topic. Please take it away.
Thank you, Kara. And yeah, thank you for all the introduction. And for that matter, everything you guys are doing here, just watching the chat, and some real some people have been really helped out by a lot of what RFR puts on, and it's just really nice to be a part of it all. So even my little bit. So yeah.
Wonderful to have you back, David, because you've certainly helped so many people. We hear about it often, through your programs, through your podcast, through private practice. You've helped a lot of people, and we appreciate you coming and sharing some of your insights and thoughts with us today.
Now I feel like I need to disappear from the camera a little bit. No, thank you. I can only hope, actually, there's been any help. So speaking of help, today's topic is going to be a lot of fun. I think we have 83 here so far participating, and very much so. If questions come up, go ahead and ask. I will always be multitasking by looking at the chat. And if something is big, then definitely we'll answer. Otherwise, I'll be staying on for a bit, afterwards. So that's all good. And yeah, it looks like people had some fun with the initial polling questions. I think I actually saw a question concerning who is Clarice Starling, and shame on you. Shame. Wow. Shame on you.
Are we old? Is that the problem?
What's that? Maybe. I have to turn my hearing aid up.
Yeah. Although there is, although at this point, you don't even have to watch the movies. There's the new, ABC, Clarice.
Oh,
has that been renewed?
What is this, a new show?
Yeah, I think it's gone. I think it's one or two seasons old now. It's really, really well done. Like, yeah, I think it's a Paramount Plus is what it used to be, is what it currently is on. So highly recommend. It's brilliant writing, and the actress who plays Clarice is really, really good. So well worth watching.
Okay.
No, I'm not getting any kickbacks from Paramount. So it's, I just love, yeah. Jodie Foster will always have a special place, but, and yes, Paramount is also where all the Star Trek is at. And yeah, Star Trek Discovery. Yes. Love that show. Thank you. Everybody's like, yes. Okay. Anyway, tangents.
And Picard.
Picard. Yes. Second season's come out soon. Yeah. All right. We can geek out about that in the chat section.
Anyway. Yeah, let's just forget the topic and talk Star Trek. Everyone in favor, raise your hand.
The important people have raised their hands, it turns out.
And we're out.
Sorry, David. So back to you.
The idea of psychopaths, personality disorders as a general idea, of which narcissistic personality disorder and antisocial personality are but two of them. Antisocial personality disorder, or APD, is the clinical term for psychopathy or sociopath. Some people will make a distinction between the two. I don't, but it's an interesting conversation to have with some. And this is obviously something that all the way back to when psychologists were referred to as alienists, before there was even a profession, the study of what was, outside of the norm, particularly when it comes to criminality, is definitely, a topic of interest for people, not least of which is that they are seemingly so different. Yes, alienist, that is the right word. In fact, there is a wonderful book called The Alienist by Caleb Carr, C-A-R-R. And in fact, they adapted the first book to a TV show that is really well done. I was impressed. I have high bars for book adaptations, and they did really well with it.
Oh, I think I saw that, mm-hmm. and I did not understand why that was the title of it. Okay.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. It was one of the more psychoanalysts at the time. They weren't, clinicians in the sense that therapists are now, although that's also kind of broadening that term. It's an interesting history on that. And yeah, it's really, really well done. There's actually a second book written by the same author, and I think it's Angel of Darkness. Really well done.
Ooh.
Yeah,
okay. I'm checking. So, I just dropped the link to the book in the chat. I'm gonna check that out myself later.
Really well done. And so, of course, obviously, they've got everything these days from Criminal Minds to which I think is still going on. I'm not sure.
It seems like it's never going to end. I mean, I'm not sure.
It's like CSI. They just keep, new versions of CSI just keep coming out. They've got a recipe. It does well. The Mentalist, not quite Criminal Profiling. That one had more to do with almost high functioning autism, sort of. Very interesting. CSI, of course, there's like, I think, 100 versions of it now.
Yeah.
But hey, they're fun. Recently got hooked on the CSI Hawaii version. So.
I haven't even seen that one. I think I quit after New York or whichever.
Gary Sinise.
Yeah. I mean, it's quality programming. Well, what do you think is, Dexter. Why are these?
Yeah.
Why are these so popular with people? What is the fascination here?
Right. Well, I think, one of the biggest things with this is frankly related to the third question. It's like, how different do you believe yourself to be from narcissists, psychopaths, people with personality disorders? And the majority is hugely different, and of course, mostly different. And there is this fascination with the other. And it just anytime, particularly if you can combine other with the macabre or, you know, danger, particularly if you can experience that danger in a way that you will never feel yourself. Hey, you know, it's great. I think it's the same proclivity that people that watch, you know, daytime talk shows and, you know, enjoy watching families implode on national television. There's just the fascination. So you're like, I am not that. It's real. Ultimately what it boils down to.
Hi, I'm Gail Jordan, Executive Director of Recovering from Religion. RFR has been providing hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief since 2009. We have a 24-hour telephone hotline and internet chat, an online community, local support groups, a podcast, blog, and a vast collection of resources. We offer this support at no cost to the folks who reach out to us. 3 years ago, we added a weekend recovery retreat set in the cool mountains of North Carolina. This is a weekend of socializing, learning, decompressing, and building community. Your contribution can help with subsidizing the cost of someone wanting to attend. Please join us for our annual fundraiser on February 19th, or visit us at recoveringfromreligion.org and click on the Donate tab to join our team of donors and volunteers. From the bottom of my brain, thank you.
Okay, third this is like... Of...
Sorry.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Sasha.
Oh, sorry. My apologies with the internet connection. Is there an element of like a voyeuristic sort of trying to just watch car crashes happen that people want to watch these shows or see this sort of interaction in society? Is that what kind of drives a lot of this very popularity?
So. Yeah, no, very much so. I mean, it's that it's, so I think I saw a recent meme where, you know, it's like somebody, you know, watching on their couch, you know, a show on real murder and they're like, you know, the person announcing it, it's like, oh, they left their, you know, their hairbrush behind or something like that. And the person on the couch is like, moron, you know, I mean, he's, so there's multiple layers, I think, of being like, that is not me. I am better than that. And at the darkest points of most of our lives, we can look at people who are suffering from, you know, these personality maladjustments and go, well, I don't have to deal with that. So things aren't that bad.
I do that with cooking shows. I watch cooking shows whilst eating junk food on the lounge, analyzing how poorly they've cooked. So is that part of it?
Oh,
definitely part of it.
Wow. Yeah. I think my cooking skills are not as good as yours, Sasha. That is not my experience watching those shows.
I look at them and say, you forgot to put the ingredient in whilst I'm eating something that just nothing fancy.
Yeah. I'm normally just going, wow, that's a lot of butter while I'm, you know, dipping something in sauce.
I love it. Yeah. Yes. That's too much as I, yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah. And part of this goes into, and we'll be going through like, what is the nature of personality disorder? What's the nature of personality? How does this relate to relationships? What is the nature of, and we're going to focus on narcissism and antisocial because we don't have 4 or 5 hours. You know, this is just as a caveat. This is not going to be about diagnosing your current or former relationships. That is not what I'm going to be doing on here. If you were to ask me, I will not give a definitive answer. I'm just going to tell you right now. I don't go there. It's an ethical line.
Okay, I was about to ask, is that because it's really kind of difficult to do that outside of a clinical setting?
Quite. Which is kind of hinting at the second question in the answer of going like, hey, they weren't diagnosed, but I just know they would have been.
Right.
I mean, it's one of the, not to say that, hey, you might even be right. It's quite possible. Generally speaking, probably not though. Somebody's armchair diagnosing. One of the first things you have probably heard, if you or should have heard, is that like first, you know, psych class is like, do not take this and diagnose your family and all your friends. Like this is a little more complicated. And we'll go into why, actually. I mean, it's not just like, hey, we want to have our own little niche and get paid, you know, big bucks, or at least some of us do. We need to be careful about labels and using, mental health issues, particularly when it comes to using them as pejoratives. You know, it's right. One thing for people to, say, hey, we need to be, more empathetic and careful around, mental health diagnoses related to like depression and anxiety and so on. On the other hand, they are, people who suffer from these are also worth, empathizing with, even as you stay as far away as possible when it comes to engaging in intimate relationships. And so, this is the compassion part of my spiel, and then we'll move on.
Is that also, David, that the why we always have the caution now in society, we shouldn't use expressions like saying somebody is crazy or someone's acting. We've learned now to be very careful with the types of words and expressions that we use in our day-to-day conversation.
Very much so. There's that, and as well, there is a tendency to look at people with personality disorders as if, they're, and again, that comes back to that other, where they're coming in almost like hatched from an egg, and therefore, they're not feeling the same thing that you and I feel. Well, yes, they are. In fact, particularly when it comes to like narcissistic personality disorder and borderline, the vast majority, seems to be, it's a development after severe abuse and neglect, where they are adjustments to some really awful childhood and adolescent upbringing. And again, this is not a, this is in no way giving carte blanche to the behaviors at all. This is simply going, it was a, or for that matter, in the case of sociopathy, they didn't choose it. This is one of those where the wheel of genetics and environmental influence got turned and they came up really bad.
So is that an element of understanding why somebody is the way they are, but not necessarily mm-hmm. condoning the behavior or the conduct, but just having empathy for why they may have acted a certain way?
Right. And again, yeah, very, 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 very clear. This is not about being okay. And this is not about, you can fix them continuing on with an intimate relationship. This is not that. So in fact, what makes it more troubling is that there really is a general lack of treatment for many of this. It's one of the reasons why personality disorders in general have been looked at as the way that we've been looking at them for a while is probably not been accurate. And we'll cover that actually in a little bit. So when we start going through, we have to start with essentially what is personality? Most people probably have encountered the term when taking the rather ubiquitous number of personality tests on Facebook and other social media. People will immediately ask what Myers-Briggs you are. I won't take the time to get into the criticism of Myers-Briggs. But basically, as far as, like the American Psychological Association and others take a look at, the personality is kind of derived from two different things. One, the nature of self, which is itself broken down. The self itself is broken down to a sense of identity. So the experience of yourself as unique, clear boundaries between self and others, you know, the ability to regulate, you know, a range of emotional experience. So it's like, okay, this is how I'm structuring my overall idea of who I am in self. And then there's, of course, the capacity for self-direction. So you're pursuing coherent, meaningful short-term and life goals. You know, you have the ability to self-reflect in a productive way. Notice productive does not mean you have to agree. It's just getting them closer to whatever goals they might have. And that is, of course, we here. We are talking about everybody here. So there's the nature of the self, and then there is the interpersonal dynamics of what a personality is defined or understood as. And that gets broken down to empathy and intimacy. So empathy, of course, comprehension, appreciation of others, looking at a question about the self. We'll get to that later. You know, comprehension and appreciation of others, experience and motivations, tolerance for differing perspectives, understanding effects of one's own behavior on others, which is an interesting point there, because within that, you know, the common understanding, for instance, of like psychopaths is that they don't have empathy. Well, they do and they don't. You know, the capacity for feeling another person is decidedly lacking, but the capacity to understand and appreciate, and by appreciate, I do not mean a moral sense of that term. It's just a kind of like assessment, but it's an appreciation for how their actions will affect others. Kind of have to. I mean, at some level, depending on where on the psychopathy scale you fall, as far as where you fall on the side of criminality, which again, not all psychopaths are criminals. There's that. But you have to have a pretty visceral idea of how you are going to get what you want. And that requires a certain level of, or a certain type of empathy.
So is it more of a, like, not so much that there's a lack of understanding so much as a, like, just a not caring or?
Yeah, I mean, the general notion of that in the internalized feel of like, I know what you feel like. Mm-hmm. There are some critical pieces that's not entirely what's going on, but that's a whole other issue. But what is happening is that notion of you are reflecting within yourself what you believe another person is experiencing, and you're close enough that you continue to have conversations. And it's like, okay, yep, this works. Generally speaking, you know, that is not, you know, they just have lost that capacity for a variety of reasons. But the instrumental empathy, which is a, you know, a form of it, is basically the idea of like, I recognize how my actions are affecting you in a broad sense of that, of the effect term. And really, it's pretty rare for that to actually go away completely. Otherwise, I mean, we'd run into traffic, or there's a certain baseline of being able to see what I do affects other people. Now, the degree to which you understand it is obviously, I mean, all you have to do is just watch a bunch of kindergartners to realize that that's a developmental thing. I mean, it's just like, and then of course you just have to probably bring to mind certain adults that are like, do you really get that when you did A, this, mm-hmm. you know, it's weird. And so, but even then, in fact, I made a bit of a mistake there as far as even the scenario, because often what's happening is people are immediately going to, when don't you understand that when you did A, I felt B. That's not the important piece. They're looking at when they did A, how did you respond outwardly? And so they can kind of, like we all do really to varying degrees, of figuring out, well, when I do this, this is the effects. And this is how I then can organize, you know, my next, you know, piece of experience and so on.
So would it be more of a mechanical reaction rather than an empathetic, heartfelt reaction in the behaviors?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very instrumental. You know, it's like using a kitchen utensil. Yeah, you know, right. It's nobody cares about the fork. Like they just know that if you stab it, it's going to pick up the food and you can eat it.
Okay, so in this metaphor, people are the utensils.
Yes.
They're not the boats, but they're the utensils.
They're the utensils. Yeah. We're not doing the boats again.
No, we're not.
So that sure
might be.
We'll get off that ship. No, we'll.
Yeah, jump ship.
So
I'm jumping.
David, on a lot of those things that you mentioned there, they and I don't want to derail the topic, so mm-hmm. keep me on track if necessary.
Yeah, you're good.
But
the train.
I heard what I said as soon as I said it. Okay. So a TV show series called You has been quite popular on whatever platform, streaming platform it is. And there's a
Heard very good things.
Right. And he has some very serious personality issues, but he fakes the ability to feel empathy. He fakes the ability to feel for other people while still justifying the most heinous of behavior. Is that the sort of thing? There's a learned response on what they think they should act like, or?
Yeah, I mean, so obviously we always have to have a huge brick of salt whenever we're you know, looking at the entertainment version of, well, for that matter, mental health just in general. So it is pretty rare for any of that to be something that, like, you know, sure, this is just what they all look like, right? No, thankfully. I mean, and really for that matter, it would be like saying, you know, there's a depiction of depression, therefore everybody experiences it the same way. Anybody who's experienced depression knows that there are variations in it. And the last thing you want is to be, you know, dismissed or almost equally bad, looked at as being hyper problematic because one person who's, you know, had depression now, you know, was exhibiting it in a way that was highly disruptive. I mean, so we really have to be careful about universalizing a lot of this. In fact, I'll just go ahead and note here, it's one of the reasons why there are a lot of problems with personality disorder diagnoses. Because one, the definition of them is a little uncertain, very vague. The range of severity is across the map. Identifying key dimensions of them, you know, it's a peculiar thing that when you diagnose somebody with one personality disorder, generally speaking, they will meet the criteria for at least two more. You're like, well, wait a minute. Clearly, there's not a clear demarcation between these. So what are we actually talking about here? There's a lack of treatment research. And then of course, as well, even when those who are diagnosed, there is a huge breadth of behavioral differences between people who supposedly have this singular disorder. And so all of that, personality disorders actually almost got removed from the latest DSM. In fact, if you want to purchase one, see if you can find one online. In fact, there's a new, there's the DSM-5 TR, so a revised edition coming out here in a few months. But in the back of the DSM-5, there's actually a completely different, it's an appendix that goes through a very different way of looking and conceptualizing personality disorders. And highly recommend it. It's interesting. I'm not entirely certain I still agree with it, but it's interesting.
So basically you're saying one size does not fit all and that there's no easy way to put people into boxes.
No, it really doesn't. And good, and good for that. And part of that goes into, you know, the nature of, for instance, like, so the interpersonal notion of how it relates to personality, you know, the intimacy idea. It's going, okay, wait a minute. As everybody, I'm sure, on here, if we were to ask, you know, how do you relate within intimate relationships, we'd probably have, let's say we've got 83 participants, 83 variations on that. And, you know, to be able to then say, well, this is the right way of discussing intimacy. You know, this is the right and only way of discussing relationship is just not going to really, really helpful. So, which actually will touches on the very end when we get into some healthy ways of dealing with some unhealthy relationships and their connection to personality disorders. So I will put a pin in that one.
That sounds super helpful. That sounds really connected to me with a question somebody just asked that kind of follows on with that, where they're saying, well, you know, don't we all fake empathy sometimes without being narcissists? Like, where's that line?
Yeah, I mean, really, it could be there's at least some aspect of learning what it is to feel, or rather to have an emotional experience that is a learned sociocultural experience. Like it's, in fact, one of the books that, you know, put on resources that'll be, you know, sent out at the end, and I've spoken of before, is the, you know, constructivist version of, you know, emotion, Lisa Feldman Barrett, amongst others. And once you get to a, like, feelings are one thing, they're that internal, like, just kind of energetic, like, feeling of intensity and importance. And then there's emotion, which is the verbalization of one's, you know, experience, but those are socioculturally derived, you know, so, and we learn those. I mean, we learn what it is to express sadness. We learn what it is to express happiness and everything in between and everything else through the relationships within the, you know, social and cultural milieu that we're all had no choice really to be involved with when we were born. So there is a part here where we're all kind of faking it till you make it, and we all are faking it together enough that your version of faking is close enough to somebody else's version, and we just all kind of go, well, this is awesome, great, we're doing the right thing, sort of. I mean, until, and here's it is, somebody comes along and displays something completely different, and then what do? Well, now they're other, and this is a problem, and we slap a, you know, some pejorative label on it. I mean, it's, you know, I love, you know, Joan of Arc, for that matter. You know, it's, from a modern perspective, we could probably look back and go, oh, you know, schizophrenia. Maybe. Mm-hmm. Maybe. I mean, for her to actually have been able to go back and talk with her, would she have actually exhibited the characteristics that we would associate? Is that how she felt her experience to be? I mean, there's a reason for, and I have my questions about it, but there is a reason for one of the points behind, for instance, general criteria for personality disorder. One of them is that the impairment are not better understood as normative. So essentially just within the bounds of their social culture is for the individual's development. So, or their sociocultural environment, which is why, generally speaking, we don't, as clinicians, diagnose, you know, religious believers as having delusional disorders. Mm-hmm. It's different, of course, and this gets a lot of fun, and I'll try not to go too much of a tangent here, but, you know, this really does, a lot of this goes into really how nebulous a lot of this stuff is, and how any time that you feel like you've got, you know, this kind of definitive or concrete way of understanding from psychological science, this is what people are. This is the latest, a label to apply. Odds are you should really take it all with, again, probably not even a brick, but an entire warehouse of salt. And be very careful on just how widely we're using these terms. I mean, it's highly problematic. OSHA boatload. Oh my gosh, we've started a new thing of salts. Okay.
We're back to the puns. For those who are watching this later, we have some puns happening in the chat.
Yeah.
This seems to happen every time you're here, David. This must be your doing.
I consider it a benefit of my personality disorder, I'm sure.
Would that mean that we're insulting you if we're talking about that?
I really enjoy every moment of it. It's a lot of fun. So David, I
do appreciate that point that you made there about the need for, to use a grain of salt, to be very cautious, particularly with this topic, and that we're always growing, we're always evolving and how we define things. And it's very unwise to get into a field of defining people. But you have talked about personalities, the natures of relationships, the criteria for personality disorder and that sort of thing. But is there still a general way where characteristics of say a narcissistic personality disorder or something can be seen, or is this so vague and ambiguous as you were saying?
No, I mean, it's definitely, so anytime that I speak about labels being problematic, it's not about getting rid of them. One, good luck. Our brains are classification systems. I mean, there's a reason why we see images in clouds. Are the images there? No. We're making this stuff up. And it's not necessarily a bad thing. Like we need to figure out how to organize our experience so that we can effectively predict, okay, in the future, when I encounter something similar, I can draw from my past experience to be able to then deal with what I believe is coming up. And we do that to varying degrees of success. And that's really what it comes down to. You know, one way of looking at personality then is a way of organizing your experience to support a structure for how you're going to behave given a particular situation that you've identified that you find yourself in. And so what ends up happening is that over the course of a certain amount of time, we develop, maps, so to speak, of I like to go this way when I want to go to, the store. I like to go that way when I want to go to Disneyland. Just the other day, I was talking with somebody about, there was a couple from, I live in South Dakota, and, they went to Florida for a few months to get away from the winter. And they talked about, oh no, I remember driving to Florida. It's like 36 hours. And well, I haven't gone back. I haven't driven there again, but I know the way I wouldn't go. Like, wait a minute. There are multiple ways of getting to Florida? Well, of course there are. Just like there are multiple ways of navigating every form of relationship out there, from work to personal to intimate and all the variations in between. It's in those variations and those paths that we believe are accurate and right and we self-identify with, welcome to being your personality. The nice thing is we can change, we can adapt, we can grow, we can expand. Thankfully, if we were to respond the exact same way all the time, we'd be throwing toys at people just like we were doing when we were three. Every time somebody, ticked us off, we learn otherwise. So, but getting into then, general criteria, it's like, okay, well, how does this work then in practice? There are stuff that's socially acceptable generally, and then there's stuff that is then deemed, for good reason, often, illegal, unethical, and so on. Not always, but often, good reason. So you have, for instance, it has to have a significant impairment in the person's life. This is why it's a little difficult sometimes to diagnose when the other person's, when the person's life is kind of hunky-dory.
So what would that be? What is a significant impairment, like, for example?
Welcome to some more nebulousness. So if basically, you know, if we were to bring it down to, like, say, depression, everybody experiences sadness and depressed states at one or more times in their lives. It's just part of being human and dealing with loss and dealing with change and so on. Where it comes to the point of being an impairment is when some part of your life, personal, work, interpersonal, is no longer functioning in the way that used to be, that was that was helpful, or productive, or, you know, otherwise looked at as healthy. So now where that goes is, of course, individual. And further, you add in the complication of, well, what if the form that things were occurring at the time was, generally speaking, unhealthy to begin with, but they just kind of got used to it. Abusive relationships being one of them. Like, you just kind of get used to it because this is what you understand and know, recognize how to work through, even though everybody around you, and often even you yourself, will go, this is not good. But, you know, how often have we ever heard, I don't know other way to be or to move on to? So, So at that point, then, when the experience itself is unhealthy, where do you go? Like, at what point then do you start saying, well, now you have a, depressive disorder or something else? Well, wait a minute. They were operating within an awful environment. Mm-hmm. The fact that they're having negative experiences out of that, is that a disorder, or is that a natural effect of being in an awful place?
So the kind of thing where you might not necessarily be able to point to, like, a particular behavior or statement or something and say, this is narcissistic. It's kind of a big picture kind of look at what's happening and whether it's causing the negative situation.
Very much, yeah, a lot of it. And that's where, and this is where you go from traits to actual, like, full-on personality constructs. And this is where, again, you come back to, okay, so, and that's an excellent question about the former president. I will get to in a second. So you have, you know, so there's an impairment. One or more of the pathological personality traits fall, you know, within what has been pre-designated as being, you know, a trait of one of these. Further, those traits are relatively stable across a significant amount of time, mm-hmm. which is where we get into a little bit of some of the difficulties behind, people I've dated have been this, because who knows? We don't know how consistent they've been, on that. It could be that, it's any number of other reasons why they're, being this way. Like it's the only thing.
Are you saying I might be the common denominator here? Like, if I picked all of my previous relationships, have this problem?
No, because I am not going to go down the path of blaming the victim here. Not at all. There is something to be said about, again, we come back to personalities and the way that we structure our experience and the way then that we decide, okay, wait a minute. When faced with A, in the past, I've done B and it resulted in me moving forward into a C result. Well, that's stable. I know how to handle it. And okay, and I've got my skills and resources set up to be able to deal with it. Okay. That has nothing to do with whether or not the whole sequence is ultimately healthy by another perspective. Mm-hmm. So when you, at times when that question comes up, like, wait a minute, why do I always seem to like go for this type of person? Mm-hmm. This is not about taking on a blame. This is about taking stock of, well, wait a minute, how am I framing things? And what do I feel myself capable of doing that this is the situation that I feel best equipped to be able to deal with at some level? That's a wholly different conversation. Any more than it is somebody in an abusive relationship who's going, you know, well, no, but I understand, how to deal with this. And I've literally had clients who are like, no, I understand how, like, if I do this, then he'll do this or he won't do this, or yes, she as well. And like, it's, you know, and so they get into this pattern of, well, you know, better the devil, you know, effectively. And often that happens then across relationships, or for that matter, dealing with anything else. If you know that you can deal with something that's awful, guess what? You know, tends to gravitate towards that thing, those things, because you know how to deal with it. It's a known entity. And one of the fundamental things that the human species is really all about is having continuity and consistency. We associate that with truth. We associate it with ethics. We associate it with mental health. And we will do a lot to make sure that something is consistent, even if it's problematic.
Okay, so it sounds like there's definitely a tendency for people, once they've been in this kind of a relationship, to maybe have that happen again and again. Is there some way that people could like recognize if they might be in this kind of pattern, or how do they know if this is something that might be happening to them?
Absolutely. Well, in fact, we can touch on then one of the things about healthy relationships, and then we can go back a bit and go through some of the basics behind narcissism and psychopathy. But
oh yeah, don't let me skip you out of order.
Oh no, you're fine. I do want to recognize experiences being shared in the chat. If at any point later on, I won't say the person's people's names, but afterwards, I will be more than happy to work with you on helping out finding resources. So
just on that point too, David, yeah. Thanks to those who are putting the comments in the chat, and we want to acknowledge that a lot have gone through what seems like some very traumatic and difficult times in their life, and we appreciate you sharing some of those things. And yeah, thank you for feeling comfortable to share, and perhaps reach out to David privately and we might be able to help with chats about that.
Very much you are supported as much as can be through the screen and otherwise. So we will address that. I will say that the idea of posting a picture, as it was said about that, that's a terrible idea. Who came up with that? Seriously. Anyway, so when it comes to healthy relationships, we'll touch on one place and then come back to it, is paying attention to how conversations happen. You know, is someone asking all the questions? Do you constantly find yourself, and this can be either way, because it can be problematic either way, like are you finding yourself asking all the questions because the other person is so, you know, like, well, I'm gonna be mysterious, or you got to find out. And so there's a point at which there's shyness, and there's a point at which there's wanting to keep things private and so on, and then there's a point at which you're having to ask so much because otherwise you have to make so much up because they're not giving you any information. That's a big red flag. And in the reverse, if you are never allowed to ask any questions and everything is about, I just want to know more about you. Really? It sounds nice, and often it can be, but if that is the constant rejoinder, okay, red flag, let's check in and see what else is going on. And part of that is, do you find yourself trying, having to make a ton of assumptions about this other person because you're filling in the gaps due to an immense amount of ignorance because they just don't bother telling you. Or when they do, it seems to contradict other things before. And then when you ask for clarification, you know, they'll either get really upset or start, you know, this is where tactics like gaslighting and so on come into play. So for that matter, when was the last time that you actually felt emotionally vulnerable and saw your partner expressing similar? So emotional vulnerability is part of a healthy relationship. But when was the last time you actually felt that? And when was the last time that you kind of shared that experience then with the other person? Now, does that mean that if you haven't, all of a sudden you're dealing with somebody with personality disorder? No. These are, you know, points of consideration to take stock of what's going on with whatever relationship you happen to be looking at, whether it be intimate, friend, or work, or family. And you kind of leave the labeling of in diagnosing to others. Because the point here is, it doesn't, in the end of the day, matter whether or not they have a serious mental health, issue like a personality disorder. It only matters that you are able to identify what is unhealthy and then be able to get yourself away from it. Doesn't matter whether or not they're labeled or not. I do not care. If you're in an unhealthy relationship, the point is to be able to find a way to see it and then remove yourself from it. Leave the diagnosing to, you know, probably future therapy for yourself as you work through, and I don't mean that to be funny, it can be a little bit, but I mean, it's for a conversation later.
Yeah. That's a really wise point about feeling safe and getting out of that vulnerable situation or that unsafe situation. Sorry, Kara.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, yeah, I like how you put that. I have a friend who likes to say that people who are not in therapy are the reason that the rest of us are. And this definitely sounds like an example of that. But I like how you mentioned that, kind of putting the emphasis back on like recognizing if you're in a situation or a relationship that's a bad one, you know, what do I need to do to recognize that and then take steps next? What kind of advice do you have for us to be able to do that?
Yeah. How are we doing on time?
Oh, we've got probably about, I'd say about 15-ish more minutes before we go to Q&A.
Perfect. Yeah. Then I will run through some characteristics and then we'll address that question.
Yes, please do.
We've talked all the way through and never really haven't gone through the specifics. We'll say that in a link to the APA, there's a breakdown of all of these. So I will not share like every last piece of information here. You're more than happy to read those online. It's a free PDF online. So, but when it comes to an actual narcissistic personality, not just narcissistic traits, but a full-on personality disorder. Generally, you know, it's excessive, you know, has to do with impairments in self, impairments in interpersonal relationships, and then, of course, the identification of pathological personality traits. So those impairments will be excessive reference to others for their own self-definition and self-esteem. They will exaggerated self-appraisal. Emotional regulation mirrors fluctuations in self-esteem. It's like, if I feel really good about myself, whoa, I am king of the world. If I am feeling absolutely awful about myself, it is the worst thing ever, which is, again, also a bit of a common misunderstanding that anybody who is narcissistic must therefore think highly of themselves. That is actually not often what is happening. So self-direction, you know, goal setting completely based on approval of others. But personal standards are, you know, highly unreasonable, in order to then see themselves as exceptional. Vulnerable narcissism, Absolutely. In fact, it could be said that the entirety of the narcissistic disorder is based on a running away from a deep-seated self-hatred. Like that is actually one way of looking at it that I find fairly accurate.
When you say that, then it makes us feel inclined to feel sorry for the person because they're the way they are because of. What's the balance with that?
Professionals, really. I mean, this is not ever a case of if somebody is dealing with this to a severe degree, this is not, I can cure them. I have, you know, decade and a half experience working with, you know, mental health, and I wouldn't get involved and beyond the fact that I'm quite happily married to a lovely woman, I wouldn't get involved. I mean, it's just like a emotionally, intimate relationship is not the space for helping with these issues. It isn't. There's way too many other things going on. Why? I mean, intimate relationships should be about, you know, mutual expression and growth and sharing new things and challenge and so on. To look at them as a medium for, you know, getting better mental health, kind of problematic, just to be frank. And I say that as a lifetime member of the White Knight Syndrome party. So, you know, it's there. It's really not helpful. But it is you are right. It is a thing of, you know, feeling a little bit like, oh, well, crap. Like, okay, so this is a response to and trying to, you know, deal with something that's awful. Unfortunately, it's that exact empathy on our part that ends up getting used as instrumentally to then pursue quite awful relationship outcomes. So, yeah, it's a whole lot. With some of the stuff that's being mentioned in the chat, yeah, there's really some awful stuff.
Yeah, that sounds, I mean, really kind of just almost like a vicious cycle kind of situation. If it's, you know, someone finds themselves kind of compelled to feel that empathy towards someone, and then, you know, you get matched up with somebody who's going to use that against you. Yeah. That could really be unfortunate.
Yeah.
Oof. Okay, so it kind of goes back again to what you were saying about, you know, needing to check for ourselves and make sure we're putting ourselves in healthy relationships and dealing with things appropriately.
Yep. Ooh,
excellent.
Absolutely.
And I realize you're moving along with the outline, but I want to acknowledge to those in the chat who are throwing questions. We are taking note of them. If we miss one, we do apologize, but Cara and I are keeping a note of the questions at the moment. Mm-hmm. We have about 15 that we want to put to David, so we need to allow enough time. But again, if you have any other questions, put them in the chat and we will add them to our list to ask David.
Thank you. So just to finish up narcissism real quick, and again, I'm skipping over a lot of things, by all means, read the resources, but, you know, often being looked at as like grandiosity, attention seeking, and it's not just grandiosity in the sense of feeling really good or getting a legitimate sense of, feeling a sense of accomplishment over something that could be pretty big, and it could be really big to that person. Like, you know, our accomplishments are determined as to their weight largely by our own assessments. So what is huge to one person may not be a big deal to another. And it doesn't mean they're necessarily, you know, narcissistic. It just means, wow, they rocked and let's celebrate that. But what ends up, the difference here ends up being that the grandiosity is coupled with entitlement. So it's not just about feeling good about something. It's you must see this the same way I do. So there is very little variation in alternative perspectives and in the ability that somebody else could see something differently. like, no, this is it.
Yeah.
You're not allowed to see anything, you know, else, which is where the attention seeking comes into play.
So only my perspective is the valid one. Everyone else is wrong.
Yep.
Not focusing on me enough.
Yes. In other words, everything you see on Twitter.
great.
Yeah. It's
And not open to any other perspective, or not open to being adjusted in a viewpoint.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, and now, and again, whether or not that's a trait that's being exhibited to some degree, or whether or not it's a full on personality structure, is two very different things. And so one can say, like, wow, that's really not a healthy way of communicating and being with somebody else. And we don't even have to go to whether or not the person might have this disorder. It's just, no, it's just not a healthy way of relating. So what does it matter if they have this particular label? Like, you just, no, we're not going to deal with it.
Wow. Yeah. So you've looked at characteristics of personality disorders. You've looked at some specific ones, the narcissistic personality disorder, antisocial personality disorder, and then how we can identify those things to order to have healthy lives ourselves.
Right. Yeah. Antisocial is, that's the fun one, supposedly. I freely admit one of the reasons I got a master's in forensic psych is because, you know, I wanted to jet around the nation in a single engine Cessna with the gorgeous people from Criminal Minds, because they are all gorgeous. I mean, really? Yes. So, yeah. Anyway, so psychopathy is the idea of, again, impairments in self-functioning that have to do with identity and self-direction, very egocentric. Self-esteem is derived from personal gain power. And that's to a degree that's, like, you know, maladaptive. Like, there is nothing wrong with getting a sense of, you know, empowerment through, you know, power in some capacity or pleasure or whatever. Like, that's not a problem in and of itself. It's when it becomes to the detriment of others and then you don't care. That's when we've crossed the line into serious problems. So then goal direction is based on just pure, you know, gratification. You know, it's, there's no pro-social internal standards. You know, it's very much about, you know, their own individualized form of pleasure and empowerment. This is why I love Dexter, other than the series ender. Let's not talk about that. But the character eventually became a little bizarre in that sense of the sociopath, because there came a point where his character had gotten so pro-social in his actions that, other than from the perspective of the, you know, the omniscient viewer knowing, well, he's still, you know, serial killer, anybody else would wander around and, like, you never go there. And so, in fact, when you remove the criminality component from it, which is possible, like, not, you can actually score high on, it's referred to as the PCLR, which is the psychopathy, and I totally blanked on it, I'm sorry. But it's basically a questionnaire to determine, you know, your score on the, you know, psychopathy scale. And you can actually score pretty high without any criminality. Now, criminality pretty much, like, puts you right over the line, but you can score pretty high without it. And that has to do with people having learned how to deal with their desire for empowerment through power and pleasure and so on, personal gain, without crossing the, you know, at least legal lines. Ethical lines is a whole other thing. So, because it really isn't a stretch to see certain CEOs and other and politicians, people in power, as likely being high up on that scale.
I was literally going to ask you that. We've often been told that those who are high highly functioning in on these scales are the ones mm-hmm. that take the lead in society, in politics, yeah. and business. And
yep. And in fact, and here's the irony, we often tend to applaud them for the very traits that if they were to cross us other in another area of our lives, we'd find it reprehensible. I mean, there's a little bit of a like social critic self-check to engage in. If anybody really wants to have fun, Eric Fromm, F-R-O-M-M, his book, The Sane Society, is quite good. Older, but hey, oldie but goodie. But he, you know, it's the whole idea of basically societies themselves can be, you know, psychopathic or maladaptive. Yeah. Right. So it's an interesting point to explore.
I don't want to get us too off topic here, but that mm-hmm. really makes me wonder about too, like, people sometimes talk about like gender differences in mm-hmm. these kinds of disorders. And I'm wondering, does this have to do with, you know, certain people in societies might be encouraged to be able to behave in these ways or get away mm-hmm. with these things? Is it necessarily that there's a different amount of men or women or non-binary people who have these disorders, or that it's presenting yeah. differently based on how society is reacting to them?
There doesn't seem to be really that much of a difference. It's more of what behavior is deemed appropriate, you know, or encouraged. I mean, I love going back to, historically speaking, the worst or most prolific serial killers in history have been women.
Hmm.
And not least because they weren't expected. Oh,
that's interesting.
You would never do that.
Wow.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And Madame Bathory is a personal dark hero of mine. But I mean, you know, she was capable of killing enough people to then have bats. Like literally. Like you have any idea how much blood that would take. Women historically have tended to gravitate towards poisoning, which as well is a little more difficult to detect and a little bit more where it falls into some socially acceptable behavior in the sense of self-poisoning, and yeah, it's less and it's less newsworthy. I mean, let's just be frank, but you know, blood and bodies and so on sell, and the more, you know, there's a reason why every season of like Criminal Minds and any of those shows have to up the ante in just grotesqueness, because well, there it is, like we have to keep on going with this, even though the vast majority of even serial killers do not engage in that kind of just amazing behavior. And by amazing, I do not mean to be in a positive sense of that. It's amazing and wow, that's incredible.
So yeah. With all of those different personalities that you've defined, or you've helped us to touch on, and I understand this is just like the tip of the iceberg of this whole topic that we've looked at, how can you then assist ones like all of us watching here to get into healthy relationships and to be able to be cautious about these sorts of ones that might come across us in society? What's the yeah. best advice that you would give there, or reflections on that?
Absolutely. So part of this, a big part of this comes back to the nature of personality itself and how we are all looking to kind of dwell onto consistency, and how, you know, we like things to go a way that we can predict and be a part of in a way that we feel like we can, you know, handle. And so one of the things to deal with in kind of avoiding unhealthy relationships of this kind, or whether or not it's a full disorder or it's just a bunch of traits that are just, you know, shitty, you know, it's about challenging your beliefs of what is. You know, it's challenging how you are framing what you believe your life has or must be, or or some variation of, well, this is just the way things are, right? You know, so read, well considered, you know, not the lowest hanging fruit, but well considered contrary perspectives. Deliberately challenge how you see the world in the best way possible, so that when you, so that you're not getting caught up in a kind of internalized echo chamber. You know, it's try new ways of expressing what matters to you. You know, this comes into values. And so, for instance, like you value, you know, intimacy or family. Well, okay, so you go back and go, well, I usually express my, the way that I appreciate my family or my, you know, some intimate partner in this way. Why not try this or another thing? You know, obviously have a conversation with a person about, you know, I just really love to express, you know, how much I care about you in this way. What do you think? Oh, or brainstorm together. Like, how are you going to, you know, get out of the ruts of the way things just, you know, have ought to be or should be or have always been? You know, for instance, in conversations, this can actually can be really fun. In conversations with your partner, friend, lover, deliberately discuss different answers you'd give in different circumstances. Like when you're having that heart to heart, you know, whether or not it's a really serious conversation or just having a chat. Now, say this out loud so you're not freaking the other person out, but engage in a kind of imaginative way of going, well, how would you answer that if our roles were reversed? How would you answer that if we won $1 million tomorrow? Or how would you answer that, do you think, if we found ourselves living in Bangladesh? You know, like create, you know, change the circumstance, and it allows you to, one, have fun with how your partner, friend, whatever, whoever is looking at the world. And two, it allows you to then step outside of and explore things a little differently, which, and this is, there's no trick behind it. There's no like, you know, mystery. It's the more you do these kinds of things, the more you challenge, the more you explore new ways of using your imagination. When you encounter people who want you to stay in the very rigid and narrow path that works for them, i.e. those with serious mental health issues like personality disorder, who only want one thing to happen, you will then see, wait a minute, I don't, one, like this. And two, it allows you to see it even more clearly because you're so, you become so used to being able to explore that any restriction to a, you know, in a negative way becomes like, I'm just not going to deal with it. Like, just no, I'm out. Oh. I'm going to go somewhere else.
So this is an exercise that's good for you to do just in general, but it may also help you to recognize if you're with someone mm-hmm. who's so inflexible that they're not able to do that with you.
Yep.
Oh, wow, that's healthy. Yep. And that really, I guess, is the crux of why we're having this discussion today. It's to mm-hmm. help us to be the best possible people ourselves and to live in a happiest possible circumstance and with the best people around us as possible. Mm-hmm. So you're giving us good tips on how to make that possible. I appreciate that. Yep.
Yeah, no, and that's spot on. And in fact, since we already went over the kind of, you know, pay attention to how conversations happen, you know, the last piece is really questioning what it means to be in relationship. You know, this is one of my pet peeves around this phrase is that the end of the day, we are in relationship every moment of every day of our lives. Mm-hmm. The only, the rule here is variation, not whether or not you're in a relationship or not. Mm-hmm. It's always, what form is it taking? And even within that form, what are the variations of how that appears for yourself? So, you know, you have a connection even with the male person. You have a connection with the checkout person. You have a connection even with the person on, you know, who delivered your food to you today. It might be tentative. It might be slight. It might not be certainly intimate in the, you know, in a sexual fashion. But it, you know, it's still one in the sense of they're delivering you food. Most cultures, that's a it's a pretty intimate, you know, act to engage in. You know, like they're giving you sustenance. So you're in that, you're in a relationship with them. And it's just that the form of it is what is changing. And so when we take a look at, and we get, and this is where we don't get bogged down into or get caught up in of the question of, are you in a relationship? And then if you're not, all of a sudden it's a problem for you. No, it's not a problem because you already have many. It's how are you showing up and how are the other people showing up in the way that it is mutually helpful, mutually beneficial for your personal expression, and allows for the space to grow. Period. That's really what this is. No matter what form it takes, you know, the answers to those things might, you know, shift, obviously. You're going to express and learn to grow in different ways, say through a friendship or, you know, through a marriage or whatever, but the principles are still the same. So remove notions of the one, you know, conscientiously and with consent, expand how you express your sexuality. You know, I love, what is it? Jonathan Lehmiller, Lehmiller, I believe. And he and and David Sprinkle, I believe, they have this lovely thing where like every week they're like, by the way, sex does not mean da 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 da. And they go through like just basic things that everybody says, well, of course that is. And you're like, no, it doesn't actually have to include these things. Sex is a whole lot broader than this. So consciously, you know, learn to express what it means to be a sexual being in different ways. And non-monogamy is definitely one of them, but there are lots of, I mean, I'm meaning not just relationship forms, but how you dress and how you act with people and word to express, like literally everything. We are, it's just part of who we are. Have fun with it. You know, reflectively consider how you use the term relationship. Are you narrowly applying it only to the intimate kind? Do you happily apply it to friends and family and so on? I mean, for that matter, have a little bit of fun and go up to somebody like, I love being in a relationship with you. Especially if it's a friend or whatever, like just, you know, and see what happens. Like, wait, that just weirds me out a little bit. Why?
Oh.
You know, why does it weird you out? There's nothing inherent to this other than the connection. It's up to you and how you want to express it and explore it and so on.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, these tips are really great. They're kind of about, like you were saying with the previous tip, it seems like it's kind of this habit of constantly kind of expanding your options and alternatives and the way that you're thinking about things and doing that together with the other people that you're in a relationship with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And as to the question of, is LGBT sexuality okay? The definitive answer is yes. There is no ifs, ands, or buts. If you are engaging in a consensual, non-coercive adult relationship, have at it. Whatever. It's you guys, you know, like, and that's the beauty of our ability to expand personality, to shift it, to is then the next piece of that, the kind of the connection from there is then our capacity to engage in a near infinite amount number of relationship forms. And literally every single person you encounter is an opportunity to learn to express your mutual humanity in a different way.
Oh, that is great.
Have fun with it.
I love that. And I want us to maybe end on that note if possible and go
to, we can do that,
some questions. I know you've got tons more to tell us about, and we have a whole entire slew of specific questions. Are you ready to move on to some of those?
Bring it. Let's have some fun.
Excellent. We're going to have to see if we can do the yes, no, two-second answer. To how have you got about 25 questions that we wanted to put to you from everybody? Oh, my goodness. Go for it, Cara.
All right. Well, I am really interested in your answer to this first one, and we'll get to as many of them as we can. But we talked earlier a little bit about this term gaslighting. And someone was wondering, you know, this seems like kind of a common term that people are using, narcissist, gaslighting, et cetera. Is there a need for some caution with these terms? And like, what actually, you know, should we be using that to refer to?
Yes. They are way overused. So this comes down, you know, I mentioned a little bit when it comes to narcissism. You know, I try to be, and I don't always follow even my own principle. I mean, it's a work in progress, and I get emotionally incensed about something that I see stupid. And it's like, oh, that's so narcissistic. I'm like, well, oops, gotta catch myself. And because the reality is that it could very well be just a different way of expressing their own sense of feeling good about what they accomplished. And maybe it has as much to do, maybe it's not always, again, it's not removing real issues, but there is a reflective piece to go, are you already in a bad mood? You know, is it at least in part looking at this other person and going, you know, I don't like even seeing somebody else being happy right now. So in order for them to feel really good about this, they just have to be narcissistic. Maybe. I've literally seen it work out that way. So I'm not just making this up. Now, is that always the case? No. Again, keep having to put, you know, keep wanting to throw in these things. So if somebody like edits a snippet of this audio out. But it's a really about just being a little bit more self-reflective on usage of this. So when it comes to, like, for instance, gaslighting, it's a legitimate practice that is awful. But gaslighting is not just simply somebody disagreeing with you. Mm-hmm. It's not.
It's easy to accuse somebody of gaslighting when they don't give the answer that we want.
And there's the other thing, like, a person can simply disagree or give you the answer that you don't agree or you might not like, and it's really not, that's not gaslighting. That is the capacity for the other person to have a different perspective on things. Doesn't mean that we can't talk about ethics. Doesn't mean we can't talk about anything else. I'm sorry, I keep throwing out the caveats. But it is this, you know, it's a tendency to, and we come back to that conversational piece. And that is, what are we doing if, in fact, what was that, the piece concerning a healthy personality when it comes to empathy, is the ability to explore and navigate alternative and different perspectives.
Hmm. Yeah, that's really interesting. You know, and that kind of reminds me of one of these other questions. We've got a whole ton of these questions, so I'm going to try and go through as many as we can that kind of segue with where you're going with these answers. Do you feel like it's easy to spot someone who might be having a tendency to do these things or exhibit these behaviors, and how do we go about that?
Yeah, so this kind of touches on the whole, you know, former president question as well, there's a rule, Gladstone or something, that was brought up years ago about, you know, psychologists not engaging in diagnosis of public professionals who they are not actually seeing as a client. And I largely abide by that in the sense of, I don't know enough. And now, can you identify traits? Can you identify maladaptive things that you find unethical and problematic to varying degrees? Yeah, absolutely. And we can learn, you know, it's part of why, you know, the you know, the principles that we're talking about in healthy relationships earlier are all about figuring out how to expand conversations, figure out how to expand your own personal expression in multiple areas of your life. Because when the one thing about people who are wanting or already are engaged in unhealthy forms of relationship is that they want to do the opposite. They don't want variation. They don't want broad expression and having the space for. Now, throw in a caveat to that. This does not mean that if you encounter someone who is, for any variety of reasons, is simply uncomfortable with certain aspects of how a person may want to express their sexuality, for instance, doesn't mean that they're involved or want to be involved in an unhealthy relationship. Mm-hmm. It's when they are uncomfortable and then expect you to, you know, engage in that same level of discomfort that there is a problem. Mm-hmm. Everybody still has their boundaries and they can happily go about doing that. There is nothing wrong with personal boundaries. Wanting to express yourself is within your own realm of comfort, and that's fine. You know, obviously I'm going to encourage to safely bump up against the discomfort a bit to a degree that's helpful. But otherwise it doesn't mean blowing down everybody's boundaries simply because we can. It's about, again, engaging in that kind of mutual non-coercive conversation. And so the trick is to look at and go, okay, this person has boundaries. Are they expecting me to abide by them? And if so, that may be fine if that's the relationship you want to engage with in them. If it isn't, then you do something else.
And so that brings us to another couple of the questions there too, that do narcissists or people with a personality situation usually present differently in public than they would with the ones who they're close to? So, you know, you talk about what is appropriate and with boundaries and right behavior. So would a narcissist present a public persona that seemed normal and then save the manipulation or the poor behavior for those closest?
So it's difficult to answer. I mean, in the sense of it's yes and no. And it's yes and no precisely because everybody exhibits different behaviors depending on if they're in private or public. It doesn't mean that there's anything pathological to it. I mean, you're simply not going to have the same conversations with your buddies as you would at the workplace, at least most likely, and certainly with different consequences. You're not going to, you know, wear the same clothes, engage in the exact same behavior with a intimate partner as you would with a casual friend. That doesn't mean you're pathological. It means every context is drawing out variations in behavioral responses. Okay. That being said, quite often is when you see a person in different contexts and they're consistently, for instance, from the narcissist, if they are consistently making everything about, you need to all acknowledge what I have done to even your detriment. And that principle stays the same, even as they might exhibit that a little bit differently in public or in private. Well, now you might have an issue of going, ooh, okay, I need to pay attention to this. You know, what's that old, you know, piece of wisdom about before getting really serious with somebody, you should see them around their family or close friends. I mean, sometimes that doesn't always work, but quite often, yeah, you want to see this other person in other social contexts, because it becomes really difficult to maintain, you know, the whole TV version of like, oh my God, they appear this way, and then, you know, they're absolute like psychopaths otherwise. The more contexts you see them in, it becomes really difficult to maintain that. Like it's that takes a lot of energy to maintain that level of fakery, and which is totally a clinical term, fakery. And so you're going to see it.
So once you do see it, we've kind of been looking from the perspective of, you know, ourselves identifying whether this might be happening, which, you know, makes sense. But doing a little bit of a perspective taking exercise here. If we were, for example, psychopaths or sociopaths or people with one of these personality disorders, would it be possible for us to kind of have insight into that or feel shame or remorse about that? And if so, like, are there things you can do to try and get better or improve?
Absolutely. And so part of, in fact, if I'm remembering right, dialectical behavioral therapy, DBT, was originally designed around dealing with personality disorders, I believe antisocial. Don't quote me. Now it's going to be on YouTube, but whatever. So I'm thinking that's correct. And so there are, and a lot of that ends up being about teaching, really teaching morality. You know, if anybody ever has been involved in the criminal justice system, there's this program called MRT, or Moral Recognition Therapy. And really what you're doing is teaching ethics.
Mm.
You know, you're teaching, you know, long-term, you know, people who have engaged in long-term criminality to recognize, oh, wait, private property is a thing. Okay. Or boundaries are legitimate, you know, social practices that I shouldn't be violating. You know, it's these things that by and large a lot of us just, you know, take for granted as, well, of course you learn this. Not everybody does, and sometimes depending on what their lives turn into, they may lose sight of that quite a bit. So it's about, you know, learning this again. Now the degree of positive outcomes of these programs is, you know, I've seen some amazing work done. They really can be life-saving. And at other times, you know, we try our best, ultimately. But it is perfectly capable. And in fact, some of the things that we're talking about with the healthy relationship, you know, ideas are also ones that can work if you believe yourself in that, you know, unfortunately, in that space where you're like, oh my God, I'm struggling possibly with this, or in fact, you've even been given a diagnosis. These are principles that can be, that can allow you to work outside of and you know, basically help with the elasticity that our brains allow us to do. And the degree of where that may be might be less than some. Mm-hmm. But you'll never know until you've tried. So yeah. We are all, it's for all intents and purposes, infinitely capable of changing ourselves within or in such a way beyond what we initially think. So
people are not frozen into a particular personality trait or personality display, but there is the opportunity for improvement. That's always helpful.
Always.
I want to acknowledge that there's still about a dozen questions, so I do apologize to everybody if your question hasn't yet been put to David. Feel free to hang around for the hangout part afterwards. We might be able to address some of those. But there's fantastic questions have come through. Kara?
Yes. Yeah, there are so many questions here, and you have taught us so much. I am just fascinated. I am on the edge of my seat. This has been such an interesting conversation to have, and I can't wait to hear more about what you have to tell us in the hangout. So this has just been great. Really, really fascinating. And what's been going on in the chat as well, it sounds like it's really resonated with a lot of people and has been really, really helpful to talk through some of these issues. So thank you so much, David, for another fantastic talk. So glad we got to be here with you.
Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to provide hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. Hope, healing, and support is waiting for you on our website, recoveringfromreligion.org. There you can speak or chat with a trained agent who will work with you through your struggles and doubts or to help find resources that may work for you. You can also find local Recovering from Religion support groups in your area for the long-term recovery work. Resources specifically curated for those struggling with doubts, disbelief, and trauma can also be found on the RFR website. To connect with a secular therapist in your area, go to seculartherapy.org and create an account. If you'd like to support the work that RFR does, you can donate or sign up as a volunteer on the Recovering from Religion website. It's also a big help subscribing to the RFR YouTube channel, our blog, or following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to us at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll be with us next time on the Recovering from Religion podcast.